Good evening again. Really enjoying this meeting, not only for seeing a lot of you here at Eastside, but people coming from the area. I see a lot of faces I recognize. Thanks so much for supporting this meeting and encouraging us in our work. I want us to talk about something tonight that interests people less and less in the broader sense. I've seen a number of articles online where people are concerned that the number of people studying this area of academics that we're going to talk about tonight, that has declined. There are one-third less majors in this area of study than there were in 2011. Why such little interest now in this topic? And of course, broadly, we're going to be talking about history, but we're going to be looking about lessons from the Bible, history, learning history's lessons from the Bible. Talking with a young person, I think I heard this on an interview. Someone asked, why aren't you interested in history? The answer, I don't really see how it affects me in any way. I guess that's a typical postmodern answer. But it does affect us, especially biblical history. We can't really know who we are, and we can't know where we're going, or at least where we ought to go, if we don't have some understanding of history, and especially biblical history, and the history of people who are striving to follow God. So that's what I want us to begin to study. It's kind of a two-part lesson, tonight and tomorrow night. Tonight, we're going to look at the importance of history in the Bible. That will be the first half of the lesson. Then we're going to apply that to what we sometimes call restoration. We're going to look at historical songs of the Old Testament, monuments, memorial feasts in the Old Testament. Then we're going to look at just a brief summary of some of the New Testament references to history. But let's look at some of the historical songs. And in the book of Exodus, especially, we see Moses and in others, songs that the children of Israel sang to help them appreciate God's history. All of them have these elements. Jehovah, and perhaps the more correct pronunciation of that word is Yahweh. And I sometimes interchange those words. I'm not sure which I'm going to say. I heard Dale Smelter give an excellent lesson on that. But he is the primary focus. The Lord is the primary focus. Evil is condemned in no uncertain terms. I wonder sometimes in the songs we sing how much evil is being condemned. That's what we see in historical songs. The works of Jehovah are recounted again and again and again. Let's look at a few briefly. The Song of Moses, Exodus chapter 15. This, of course, is after the overthrow of the Egyptians in the Red Sea. And the children of Israel, full of praise and thanksgiving to Jehovah who has saved them from the sea. Verses 1 through 3, the whole song is full of important lessons for us. But the first three verses, then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for He is highly exalted. The horse and its rider, He is hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and He has become my salvation. This is my God. I will praise Him, my Father's God. I will exalt Him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is His name. You know, as I read these songs, I could imagine that for centuries, and I guess I have this picture of an elderly Hebrew man singing, and it would sound more in our ears like what we would call a chant. These words, as his children and others gathered around the campfire, maybe that's a little bit of an idyllic scene in my mind, but again and again, for centuries and centuries, this type of song was sung, and in part, the reason was to teach the children of Israel to remember their history and to remember the mighty works of the Lord among them. Then we have the song that Moses of Moses before his death. And here again, a lot of references. Remember, remember, remember. Verse 7, remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father, and he will inform you. Your elders, and they will tell you. What should Israelites remember? The days of old. History, if you will. This is good advice for us today. Those who do not like history or want to study history, and in particular, of course, in our context, biblical history, they're depriving themselves of an understanding of who they are. Then, in the song, Moses recounts the blessings of the Lord in their new land. But I wish to read a few more verses in this. Look at verse 15 in particular. Jeshurun, which you're going to read about, Jeshurun is a name that God gave to Israel. But Jeshurun, that is Israel, became fat and kicked. You have become fat, thick, and obstinate. Then he abandoned God who made him and rejected the rock of his salvation. We're talking about prosperity and having too much. What would happen to Israel when it became prosperous and fat is the terms that we have here? They would abandon God. They would reject the rock of his salvation. That's a warning. Be careful. And as we keep on reading, we see the same type of warning again and again. Verses 16 and 18. They made him jealous with strange gods, with abominations they provoked him to anger. You forgot the rock who fathered you and forgot the God who gave you birth. When does that happen? In times of prosperity. There's a super important point for us today. All through the history of God's people, see this as a recurring theme. Prosperity is almost always accompanied by apostasy, forgetting God, forgetting His faith. Should that make us feel a little bit uneasy? We live in the most prosperous times, probably of anyone in history. We shouldn't be surprised that people are wanting to forget God and to leave His simple ways. But the main thing is we need to make sure that we're not in that number. That instead of leaving God and feeling self-sufficient, that we're constantly giving Him thanks. Yes, for our prosperity, but more than that, for the eternal hope of salvation that He gives us. And there are other similar songs, the Song of Deborah, the Song of Habakkuk, Psalm, the history Psalms. You know, somebody ought to do this. Just get a good series of lessons on the songs in the Old Testament in particular. Maybe I'll do that one of these days. I want you to think about monuments. Monuments as efforts on God's part to impact the Israelites with the importance of some lessons that He was trying to teach them. We see these all through, especially Genesis and Exodus and the first books of history. Altars and monuments. You may remember that in Genesis 26, after the incidents with the wells, when Isaac finally was able to build a well that he was able to keep, he built a monument to the Lord. What did Jacob do at Bethel after he received the revelation from God? He built a monument there, something to remind him of this relationship that he should have with Jehovah God. And there are another cases like that, but I want to focus specifically on, and I forgot to do that there, the memorial stones at the Jordan, because God specifically stated here why He wanted the Israelites, after they'd crossed the Jordan River in flood, to erect stones as a kind of a monument. Why should they do it? Joshua 4, 6 and 7. This shall be a sign among you when your children ask later, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall say to them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever. Remember, what also do we get from this text? How important it is for our children to be taught the lessons of history. God wants us to remember the history of His people and the way that He has worked among them. And then, of course, we have the memorial feast, and the most famous one, of course, the Passover. Why did God want the children of Israel on a yearly basis to stop and partake of the food that was partaken of in the first Passover in Exodus chapter 12 and 26 and 27? God tells us, when your children say to you, what does this write, this Passover meal? What does this mean to you? Then you shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord because He passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when He struck the Egyptians but spared our homes. Remember, this is a memorial that will help you to do that. Other feasts, the Feast of the Tabernacle or the Feast of Booths. Why should they go at a certain time of the year and spend time in tabernacles or in booths? You shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And that is, sorry, I didn't give the reference on the screen. That's Leviticus chapter 28, if I can read my mark here, 42 and 43. Till today, Jewish people celebrate, remember, the Feast of Booths. Dad can tell you, he's lived in New York City, where there on the sidewalks, you have contraptions come up like this, and Jewish people are allowed to spend some time in their booths. I wonder if I were in there, what I would want to do. I think I would rather be in the wilderness of Sinai than on the 42nd Street there. But they still celebrate it to the day. And you can even rent your booth. There's some enterprising young man who will come and fix your booth on the sidewalk. And I suppose this all has the city permission. Why all of this? Remember when you were in the desert and lived that way. And just a time for some quick summaries here on New Testament references to Jewish history. It's all through it. You can't get away from it. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, references, continual references. Remember, remember, remember. Your fathers did this. Your fathers did that. You keep that in mind and you avoid their mistake. Luke chapter 17, 32. Remember? Lot's wife. Don't you be like her. Don't you look back. This is a lesson you need. Every sermon to Jewish people in the book of Acts, chock full of references to Jewish history. And I think in particular of Stephen's defense. You can see how he took the history of the Jewish people and made what should have been an overpowering argument against their system and their way of thinking. But of course, they didn't like it. They stoned him to death. The book of Hebrews. If you took all Old Testament references out of the book of Hebrews to the history of the people, you wouldn't have anything left. It's just full of it. Remember, remember, remember. Remember the children of Israel in the desert. They did not reach their rest because of unbelief. Don't you be like them. If I gave all the references, we would be here a long time tonight. You see the point. History is important for God's people. Understanding how He has dealt with His people through the centuries. And may God help us not to say, I don't like history. You may not have to like U.S. history or world history, but you need to like God's history. That's what's most important. Well, now we get to the second half of the lesson. And I want to apply some of these things to what we sometimes call the principle of restoration. It's important to know God, to know history, to know His way for us, how to avoid spiritual dangers, and we especially get that when we study this concept of restoration. We restore old furniture. You know, that's a mess there on the left side of the screen. What's happened? It's been restored. Some people like to restore automobiles. I've even watched a time or two, a little documentary. Well, I can't remember the name of the show, where they would take old beat-up cars and turn them into really beautiful models that look just like the old one. A lot of time, a lot of attention. Perhaps the people who spend the most time of all in restorations are those who restore airplanes. Years and years to find a hunk like that, hunk of metal, I guess you would call it. My wife used to call me a hunk, used to. But a hunk of metal, and turn it into something like that. Can you imagine the time and effort that would be put into that? Airplanes. But of course, we're not here to talk about that. But there's some concepts that are inherent in every type of restoration. In the first place, something good has existed. If that's not the case, you're not going to have any desire to restore it. You only want to restore what is good. But that good thing has become either lost or corrupted. And so it's no longer good. It's no longer beautiful. But if we want to go through a proper restoration, we've got to get rid of what has been added to it and has contaminated it. It may involve getting rid of the rust. It may involve getting rid of old parts that don't belong. But you've got to get rid of what has been added if you're going to have a good restoration. Everything must be returned as much as possible to its original state, because any deviation from that original state is not going to be a true restoration. Only original parts should be used. I know occasionally in restoring a car or a plane, you just can't do it. They try to manufacture the piece themselves with their metal equipment, but you've got to get as close as possible to the original for a true restoration. These things are true in spiritual restoration as well. A good Bible, we'll get into a little history here, is Josiah's restoration. We'll just briefly summarize some points that come to us from it. Josiah, the last good king of Israel, and before him, with the exception of Hezekiah, who also tried a restoration, but the kings of Judah had becoming worse and worse and worse, adding all kinds of idolatrous worship, even introducing it in the temple, which represented the dwelling place of God. Now, God gave His law to His people, and if they followed that law, they would receive blessings from Him in so many ways. And yet, the law itself had been lost, and of course, the teachings and the attitudes that accompanied it had been lost. But Josiah, as a young man, saw the need to go back to worship Jehovah God as He had commanded. And that involved the destruction of all of those corrupt additions. And you read verses 3 through 5 of chapter 34 of Chronicles, and you see all kinds of idols ground into powder. Even they took the bones of the old false prophets and ground those bones into powder. Some people might say, you need to let the dead alone. No, we've got to destroy every vestige of this idolatry which has corrupted the religion of Jehovah God. Then they found a copy of the law in the temple. You can imagine the dust covering it and blowing it off. And what do we have here? This is a copy of the law of God. So you can imagine being taken gingerly to its place. And we need to read this to the people. And that's what they did in verses 30 through 33. And as these people who probably heard there used to be something like a law, but here it is. Here is the actual law being read. Then they made a covenant, a solemn commitment. We are going to go back and follow this just as it has been stated. And then they put it into practice. And we see in chapter 35 the restoration of the Passover and how it was eaten. There again, what do you have? A pattern for every successful spiritual restoration. That's a pattern we need to follow today if we want to go back to the original, go back to God's original way. Well, let's continue. There are other restorations, of course, in the Bible. And from each one of these, we can gain an idea. And this is just a few. Just about all the prophets were fighting for restoration. But you have Hezekiah. I love chapters 28 through 30. Some of the most thrilling stories that you can read of people who had been corrupted but wanting to return to God. Now, David tried a restoration. In 2 Samuel 6, he was trying to bring back, restore the ark to Jerusalem, but he made one big mistake. He forgot about the importance of going back to the original as far as how the ark would be transported. The results were disastrous. It was an imperfect effort. Later on, I think he got it better. And sometimes some of our steps at restoration can be imperfect, but the way we avoid that, making sure we go all the way back to the original. Nehemiah worked hard to restore the system of faith that God had promoted. Also Ezra, all of those who came, the prophets who came after it. But Jesus, of course, is the greatest restorer of all. And he emphasized restoring the weightier matters of the law, restoring the heart, those restoring of ordinances about worship and restoration of the heart should go together. And that was the point of Jesus. You not only need to restore what the law says about the Passover, about tithing, you need to restore your heart. Sometimes that's forgotten today with some people who talk about restoration. If you don't start with a heart, anything that's built on that is going to be a faulty restoration. So those are other restorations that we see about. I want us to take a few minutes now just to review. For most of this, this is a review. But some of the simplicity that we see in the teaching of Jesus. And yes, here again, I want to underline that word, simplicity. His body, His church, His assembly of people. Saved people, saved individuals. All those who had been bought with the blood of Christ, all those whose names were written in heaven, that was the church. No organization, we're not thinking organization, we're just thinking people who seek God and who've been baptized into His body. That's a church. That's just too simple for some people today. But if we're going to go back and restore the beauty that we see in Christ's teachings, that's the concept we've got to work to have. Congregations that followed Him, working as families together. Simple organization. A plurality of elders, also called bishops and pastors. Simple worship assemblies. Maybe we can summarize that with Acts 2:42. They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching, and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Nothing complicated about this. This is the way that God intended His people to work together. So we have a time where early disciples met together, worshiped Him collectively, and all through the week they were striving to serve each other in humble ways. Now, I'm going to violate several rules in this next slide. They tell you don't give long quotations. I'm going to give a long quotation. Don't fill up your PowerPoint with text. I'm going to fill up the PowerPoint with text. Sometimes it's worth it, I think. This is from a letter called The Manner of Christians, a portion of a letter by Methetes. That may have been his name. That just may mean a disciple. And we think this was really soon after the death of the Apostle John. This is not inspired writing, but it gives a kind of down-to-earth illustration of the lives of early disciples. For the Christians are distinguished from other men neither by country nor language nor the customs which they observe, but they dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others, and yet endure all things as if foreigners. Every foreign land to them is as their native country, and every land of their birth as a land of strangers. They marry as do all others. They beget children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. They obey prescribed laws and at the same time surpass the laws by their lives. They love all men and are persecuted by all. They are unknown and condemned. They are put to death and restored to life. They are poor, yet make many rich. They are in lack of all things and yet abound in all. They are dishonored, and yet in their very dishonor are glorified. They are evil spoken of, and yet are justified. They are reviled and blessed. They are insulted and repay the insult with honor. They do good, yet are punished as evildoers. When punished, they rejoice as if quickened into life. They are assailed by the Jews as foreigners and persecuted by the Greeks. Yes, those who hate them are unable to assign any reason for their hatred. And I shorten that a bit. It's really a pretty picture, isn't it? A pretty picture of early disciples working together to serve the Master in His simple way, in His simple teaching. Simple ways designed not to glorify man, but to glorify the Heavenly Father. But, as you know, even in the Scriptures, we see warnings that this simplicity, there were going to be attacks against it, and attacks against the way of the Lord. Perhaps the most graphic one is Paul's warning to the Ephesian elders in Acts chapter 20. After telling them that they were to shepherd the flock and to take care of it, he gives a reason why this was important. I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among your own selves, men will arise speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them. And that happened. That prophecy became true because we began to see as the centuries passed where men began to further themselves more and more from Jesus Christ and His will. Let's look at some historical changes. We usually talk about the organization. These are things we can see in history. But all of these changes I'm going to mention were really preceded by changes in the heart. By a bit of presumption. By a bit of a determination that if we do this, we can do things better. Even though God had never mentioned it. Some of these dates are debated. Of course, in the New Testament, we see that there were elders, plural, in every church. Always plural, plural, plural. Never the elder, never the bishop. And we see that until we read the writings of a man called Ignatius of Antioch. Now, some people give the date 110 AD. I've seen that disputed, and I can kind of understand why, because he's the only one at that time that talked that way. You start seeing this a lot more at the end of the 2nd century and the beginning of the 3rd century. But he would talk about the bishop of this church. He wrote letters to several different churches on his way to be martyred. The bishop. Singular. What's happening? Just a slight change. Instead of having multiple bishops, we'll just have one. But little changes produce big ones over a period of time. Then we see regional bishops as we go on. Well, what are we talking about? Groups of churches. Groups of churches that began to be overseen by one man. Now that kind of begins to violate directly some principles we see in the Scriptures. 1 Peter 5 and verse 2 tells the elders to feed the flock of God which is among you. That was the limit of their authority. To feed the flock of God that is among you. Not to feed the flock over here in the distance or another flock over there. Feed the flock of God which is among you. But we're moving away in our study of history from what we see in the Scriptures, from what we see from the inspired apostles of Jesus. Then we have what we call the formation of the diocesan system. Now, don't get, that's probably, you may have heard of the Diocese of New York. We hear that all the time on the news and everything. What we have is a group of congregations, a group of churches that becomes a diocese controlled by one bishop. Here I'm violating my rules again, but I tried to shorten this up too. But this is stuff that helps us to understand what happened. How did we lose what we see in the New Testament? This is Mosheim. During a great part of this second century, all the churches continued to be, as at first, independent of each other, or were connected by no consociations or confederations. Each church was a kind of small independent republic, governing itself by its own laws, enacted or at least sanctioned by the people. That's what we see in the scriptures. Paul and Barnabas ordained elders in every church. Didn't appoint one elder over a bunch of churches or some elders over a bunch of churches. Elders in every church. That's what he's describing here in the first paragraph. But look at the second paragraph if you have binoculars there in the back and see it. But in the process of time, it became customary for all the Christian churches within the same province to unite and form a sort of larger society or commonwealth. And in the manner of confederated republics, to hold their conventions at stated times and there deliberate for the common advantage of the whole confederation. Where did they get the idea? Did you notice where they got the idea? Not from the scriptures. We're starting to get away from what Christ taught. They got it from the Greek society or the commonwealth. The custom extended through all churches where there were Christian churches. And of course, as you proceed, you get further and further away from the Lord and His will. We have what we could call the development of the papacy. We've already talked about a diocese, a group of churches ruled by a bishop. Archbishops. I'm not just a bishop. I'm an archbishop. It's like, I'm not just a reverend. I'm a most reverend. So these guys are moving up. Archbishops take over control of large regions. And finally, in the year 606, a man named Boniface III said, I am the universal bishop. Some historians say that the guy before him, Gregory the Great, was in actuality a universal bishop, but he was the first one to claim that. I think Gregory the Great said, anybody who claims to be the universal bishop is the Antichrist. The fellow that comes after him says, I am the universal bishop. And of course, that was accepted. But that's the way people gradually move away from God and from His simplicity. But you know, we see all these visible changes that we can read about in history. But you know what the greatest change of all was? The concept of what God's church really is. You remember what we said it was according to the scriptures? All saved people in the world. What's the concept we have here a few centuries afterwards? It's an organization that controls the people. The Bible, church, people. A few centuries after Jesus, an organization that controls the people. And that's pretty much stuck in the minds of people to this day. When you say church, they don't think all the saved people in the world. They think an organization or a tradition. That's the greatest change of all. And I just hit the wrong button again. Now it's an organization that controls the people. And so we have the Roman hierarchy, and that's the way that some people draw it. Pyramid type of structure that some say imitates the Roman period. But we're a long way, aren't we? In a few centuries, we're a long, long way away from what Jesus taught His apostles and what they taught through His inspiration. Well, we see other changes. I'll go through these briefly. Changes in worship. If you're going to have one set of changes, you're going to have a bunch of others. These dates for candles and images and rosary and transubstantiation, some of them have an official decree to go with them. And others are things that just gradually developed over a period of time. You can't be exact on all of these dates. But these are all things you do not see in the scriptures. Many of these things copied from pagan culture around. And you have doctrines and teachings, of course, that are not in the Scriptures. The idea of original sin, the idea of purgatory, celibacy, that means you can't get married. I'm wondering when that's going to change. There's a lot of changes in Romanism. That's, who knows, may still be here when that changes. Confession to priests demanded, the Bible prohibited the laity. This is interesting. Papal infallibility is a relatively new doctrine. 1870. No, I wasn't around then. Dad wasn't either. But historically, that's a rather recent thing. And it's interesting to read about the debates among the bishops as they try to determine whether we should say that the Pope is infallible or not. And a lot of people in that group of bishops objected to the idea. But when they were outvoted, they just had to go along with it. And that's the way a system of man works. You have to go along with the majority. We have the Dark Ages, what we call the Great Schism. The Eastern Church, which became the Orthodox Church, separates from the Western Church, which became the Roman Catholic Church. The Crusades, where a number of other ideas began to come in and change the system of the simple system of Christ. It's already been changed. You have corruption. You have immoral popes. Pope John XI was the illegitimate son of Pope Sergio III. Pope John XII was removed from the papacy by Emperor Otto for adultery, incest, and murder. Some of these people were nasty people. I think today you have a lot more sincerity among the leaders, but in the Middle Ages, they were nasty people. What with the Medici and all of those northern Italian families had their hands and money and all of this. You have simony. How many of you know what the sin, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but how many of you know what the sin of simony is? It comes from the Bible, that name does. Simon the sorcerer. What did he try to do? He tried to buy the position of apostle with money. And so simony is buying a position in the church. And I guess the more money you have, the higher position you can buy. So it's a type of corruption that we see. The sale of indulgences. The sale of indulgences, the permission to sin. If you can imagine such a thing. And even now, if you go to certain places, you'll be given certain indulgences for lighting a candle so many times, or certain indulgences for this, that, or the other. These were the Dark Ages. A long way away from Jesus Christ, His holiness, His simplicity that He taught His people. Then you have the Reformation. Sincere men, sometimes with flaws, rebelling against that system. Some of these names just flash on the screen are men to be admired. The Waldenses, early on. John Wycliffe translated the Bible into English. John Huss in Czechoslovakia, or Czech Republic, what we would call today, treated brutally for daring to express any desire to go back to the teachings of Christ. And whatever, don't let the people have the teachings of Christ. They may be tempted to go back to them. Then you have the one who became successful, at least politically, Martin Luther. You have other Protestant groups with many great qualities. Some areas, of course, that we would disagree with. But most of these groups look upon themselves as organizations, parts of organizations that guide the people, direct the people. And the Bible is just save people. Save people. We've got to be careful that we don't begin to look at the Church of Christ as a kind of tradition or organization that guides the people, that tells the people what to do. That's the same problem that took people away from Christ. That was the idea of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Let's guide the people. And of course, when people put their trust in those groups or any human group, you're going to get away from the original that Christ has taught. Then we see some efforts at restoration. Just going to talk briefly about this. Tomorrow I hope to talk more about this. The Anabaptists. And if you don't know who they are, we'd probably know them today more as people like the Mennonites, and they're in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, and the name is not coming to me now, but you know what I'm talking about, with the little buggies and so forth. That's what happens when you preach. The name doesn't come. You can all tell me after services the name. But the Anabaptists, they made some very praiseworthy steps to get away from the world and to go back and to imitate early disciples in their sacrifice and love for others. I don't agree with them in some areas, but they made a good effort. And of course, we're talking about restoration. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow. I'm trying to give you a teaser so you'll be back tomorrow. But we don't restore the church. Only God restores the church. But we do work at restoring some practices that have been lost. We're following the example of Hezekiah, Josiah, and others. And some efforts are more effective than others. Some get closer, I think, to what Jesus taught originally than others. Our desire is to get as close as possible to Jesus Christ and what He taught originally. And we can learn from the efforts that others have made along that line. And so tomorrow night we're going to take that on. I hope this has been helpful. I hope nobody goes out of here saying, "I hate history." If you do, I'm going to just shake my head and say, "I don't know what I'm trying to do." And now I know everybody's going to go out and tease me now and say, "I hate history." But it's fascinating to see how God's people have been through the years. And I think it's avoiding misconceptions, and there are many. But I think it's good to look at how people who share our ideals have triumphed and how they've fallen flat on their face. And that, again, is tomorrow night. Well, we'll close with this question. We've talked about the history of God's people as a great number, the masses of people through the years. What about your personal history with God? Where are you in relationship with God? Has somebody just begun to speak with you about Christ? Are you just starting to learn? Have you reached the point where you're starting to believe? If you reach the point where you've starting to believe and want to be baptized into Christ, there's no better time than right now, is there? We would love to see someone baptized into Christ tonight. Or maybe as a part of your history with Christ, you've been baptized into Him, but you've fallen away. There's no better time to request the prayers of our brethren. If we can help, if it's something that's publicly known, just let us know and we'll do what we can to assist you. Let's stand now and sing the final song.